Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. And what day is it again? Well, we turn to Cleveland, Ohio news anchor Todd Meany for help.
My boss came up to me and he said, I have this problem, and I think you probably have experienced too. Nobody knows what day it is. Wouldn't it be great just to let the viewers know what day it is? Now, obviously, we're in TV news. The beginning of the newscast starts off every day with, good morning, today is, and it's the day and the date. But we wanted to do something a little bit more, and we're a six-hour morning show, so we'd like to have a little bit of fun sometimes.
What day is it with Todd Meany?
Wednesday.
I like it.
That was March 30th, and we went right into April Fool's Day, and everybody thought it was a joke. And then we just kept doing it, and we got great response from it, and we said, hey, let's keep it going.
Welcome back to The Big Show. Now it's time for the most important question of the morning.
Yes, what day is it? With Todd Meany.
Tuesday, but I'm suspicious. For me, it's starting to get a little bit old. It's Tuesday? It's Tuesday. Guys, ready? It's Friday! Monday. So I said, oh, let's just, you know, let it rest for a couple days and see what happens. And boy, people were, where's what day is it? I don't even know what day it is. Is Todd Meany okay? Can we do a wellness check on him? So yes, we'll be kicking it back into gear. We're all stuck in this shutdown, free form kind of world with no routine. There's no dentist appointments and doctor's appointments and our overscheduled lives that we have had for years just shut down completely. And so we're all kind of wondering, what day is it? It's Thursday.
Thanks, Todd, because I wasn't quite sure, to be perfectly honest. Todd Meany provides that vital service to viewers of Fox 8 News in Cleveland, Ohio, every day. And so many of us are feeling this way. What day is it? What month is it, for that matter? I mean, well, today we are going to take a combined cosmic and cellular approach to answer this question. We will bring together a physicist and a neuroscientist to help us understand why the pandemic has so powerfully warped our sense of time. And we are going to start with a physicist. Carlo Rovelli joins us from London, Ontario, in Canada. He is a theoretical physicist and director of the Quantum Gravity Group of the Center of Theoretical Physics at Aix-Marseille University. He is also author of the beloved 2017 book, The Order of Time. Carlo Rovelli, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. Thank you very much for having me.
It is an absolute delight to have a chance to talk with you. But let me check first. Have you as well experienced any shift in your perception of time or not?
Yeah, I think so, like many people.
You have?
Definitely.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. And how has that shift in perception manifested in you? Do things seem to feel as if they're moving more slowly, or has time felt accelerated?
I feel I'm privileged. I'm in a beautiful house. I love to stay home. And so finally, I feel I have time for myself. So time is here. It wasn't there before, and I have it in my hands. Great.
Okay. So that's great news. Help us. Let's start with some basics, though. As a physicist, how do you define what time is?
Oh, this is a great question. Look, If you look at the ranking of the most common nouns in English used in when we speak, the number one word that we use is time. And in fact, among the first five, the most five used words in English, there's time, year, and day. So we talk about time all the time, any time. But precisely because of that, there was an old song that says, "'Cause you know, sometimes words have two meanings." The word time has many meanings, and we tend to confuse everything in a single... We have a vague idea, you know, time is this thing that passes, and that's time, and there's nothing to say about it. But in reality, there are all sorts of different times, and your question, what is time, has many answers, because there are many times. There is the time of our experience, what we feel, this thing we feel is passes. But that implies memories, expectation, yesterday, today, what I'm doing, how far is, how fast is flying. There is something else, that's clock time, which has nothing to do with memory and expectation. And in physics, we talk about space-time and the relativistic nature of time. Clocks don't go at the same speed. So all these times are, of course, connected to one another, but they're different notions.
Okay, so about clock time here. I'm trying to just really understand sort of what it is, because, for example, this morning I was looking at the National Institute of Standards and their new, I guess a couple of years ago, they created a new atomic clock, right? A new cesium-based clock. Yeah. It's a fountain of cesium atoms, right?
Right.
And these cesium atoms quiver, they vibrate. And it's the space between those vibrations that is somehow used as a measurement of time, right? So in the physical universe, from one quivering of the cesium atoms to the next, they're not the same thing, right? Things have changed. And is that change what we call time?
That's perhaps the most basic meaning of what we call time. Okay. Is this change. So things do change. That's a fact in the world. And the simplest understanding of what time is the counting of a change. Since ever, right? What is time? Time is day, night. It's a counting of the days. This is traditionally time. And then we go more precise, hours, minutes, seconds, nanoseconds, whatever, and the cesium clock, which is something that oscillates very rapidly, they count oscillations. And here already, if I may, the magic happens about time, because you say, oh good, now we know what is time, except that we realize that this is a very bad approximation, because if you take two of these clocks and you move them apart, and you bring them back together, they have not measured the same time.
Mm.
The one who moved more faster has measured less time than the one who just stays put. And if you take one in the mountain, it measures more time than the one who stays down in the valley. So we realize that time, it's indeed what is measured by a clock. That's correct. What is counting of something happens. But this counting depends on where you are. So the idea of a common time is because these differences are not very big, so we sort of agree on a common time that is a good enough approximation about these different countings of clock that go that are in different places.
I'm curious, did you ever see the movie Interstellar? Professor?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, so you know there's that scene, right, where they go down to a planet that's close, I guess closer to the event horizon of a black hole, and like 7 minutes passes for the crew that's on the surface of the planet. But in that same 7 minutes, the crew member that was still on board the ship, I think something like 28 years passed for him, or a long
time. Very good. That's exactly what they're talking about. And in that same movie, if you remember, at the end, the main character comes back to Earth after his trip outside in the cosmos, and he finds his little daughter, who is older than him. He's still a middle-aged man, and his little daughter, which at the beginning of the movie is a girl, it's now an old woman, older than him.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is not Hollywood fantasy. This is absolutely the way the world works. We are sure about that. In fact, a consultant for the movie was Kip Thorne, who was a very well-known relativist who got the Nobel Prize later on, not because of the movie, because of gravitational wave detection. So that part of the movie, the science is solid. So what does it mean? It means that while the main character lived a few years, the daughter lived a much longer time. Each of us, or each clock, each physical system has its own proper time. The reason we feel is the same, this conversation is going to be the same time for you and for me, is because the differences are very small.
Right.
But if we were near a black hole, for instance, or another situation, it would be much bigger.
Well, I'm not going to let us get bogged down in my quibbles with the plot of Interstellar and the insoluble paradoxes that they throw at us at the end of the movie. But this idea that if our perceptions of events or even the measurements between events are relatively similar, right? And so therefore we have the same perceived passage of time. Does that then in part begin to explain why it has felt that time has turned into something of an accordion in my day-to-day experience, that things that seemed to be predictable and measurable have been removed, and so therefore I don't really know what time it is a lot of the time.
It's two different things. Okay. There is a relation. The relation is this. There isn't a single thing which is time. That's the point.
Yeah.
there are many things that we call time that vaguely related to one another. Now, clock time, it's pretty much the same for me and for you.
Okay.
This difference I was talking about, they're absolutely real, but they're negligible between you and you. However, the time that we feel is not clock time. Definitely, we are not clocks. We are much more complicated things. We have neurons, and we have brain, and we have memories. And I think the time we feel is a lot based on emotions and memory expectations. It's more a psychological fact, which of course is grounded in clock time. It's not unrelated to it, but it's vaguely related to
it. Well, Professor Rovelli, we will be talking about that neurological time when we come back. So stand by for just a moment. We are talking about why the pandemic seems to have warped our sense of time. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/OnPoint. That's Indeed.com/OnPoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Every day is a Monday. Every day is a long week. Every day is a Monday. Every day is the day we seek. The day we seek.
And that is a song that arrived in my inbox yesterday from On Point listener Peter Murado. His original song about how he's feeling about the passage of time. And yes, every day is a Monday, and every day does indeed feel like a week these days. And we are talking this hour about why that is, why our perception of time seems to have been warped by the COVID-19 pandemic. And I'm joined today by Carlo Rovelli. He is a theoretical physicist and a best-selling author, author of The Order of Time and Seven Brief Lessons on Physics. And Professor Rovelli, I'm going to come back to you with a lot of questions about how time works or even if it exists in the at the quantum level. But since you did mention about the difference between clock time and experiential time, I want to now turn to Peter Ulrich See. He joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. He's a professor of psychological and brain sciences at Dartmouth College and a Guggenheim Fellow and author of The Neural Basis of Free Will. Peter, welcome to On Point.
Oh, great being here. Thanks for having me.
So you heard Professor Rovelli talk about the physicist's view of what time is. At the neurological level, how would you define time?
Okay, well, we have to make a distinction between, I think, three different sets of things. One is objective reality, reality in itself, to which we have no access. And then we have our consciousness, our subjective experience of that. And hopefully they're in some correspondence that is reasonable. And then on top of that, we have our models and narratives about the nature of reality or the nature of ourselves.
Okay.
Now, let's talk about subjective time.
Yeah, please go ahead.
So evolution came up with this consciousness, which is basically all we have access to. And in our heads, we don't have a cesium atom clock with quivering cesium atoms. All we have is our rate of information processing. We don't have an objective kind of clock. So we have some kind of counter that's counting the number of events that goes by, and our subjective duration of time or perception of time depends on how much information has been processed per unit objective time. Now, why does time seem to slow down when you're paying attention? When you pay attention, you're processing more information per unit objective time. And to us, subjectively, it feels like time has slowed down.
Wait, so say that again. So the our rate of information processing has changed?
Yeah. So, for example, you know, we did these experiments in the lab where we tried to get people really bored. We'd show them some event, like a little black dot appearing on the screen. And then every so often, a really weird event would happen, like a face would appear or some other oddball. And people had to judge the duration of that oddball. And we found that that oddball had to be on the screen for a much shorter objective duration to feel subjectively the same duration. And we inferred from that that when people suddenly pay attention, they're processing more information. And the counter in your head says, well, more information has been happening. Therefore, the duration has lasted longer. So there's a deep connection between our perception of time and paying attention or not paying attention. So much of the time we're not paying attention. We're kind of in zombie mode and time kind of seems to fly by. And then something really shocking happens. Let's say we're about to hit the back of a car on an icy road. And then time seems to slow down.
Right. And it seems from your experiments, you're finding that it takes a very short period of time or a very short perturbation to focus that attention.
Yeah. And I think that this evolved so that we could actually process the world in greater depth when we need to.
And so
it's
now,
like,
yeah,
it's almost like we have a fovea, you know, so our fovea processes the world in great depth, and then we have a periphery. Now, why don't we process the whole world with great acuity in our vision? Well, we'd have to have a brain the size of a building. So we have this sort of compromise solution. Attention is very similar to the fovea. We can move our internal fovea, so to speak, of processing around and then give greater depth of processing. Now, subjectively, when we do that to an event, the event seems to slow down for us.
I see. So here we are, though, in an event that is all-encompassing and long in duration in terms of how the pandemic has changed the experience of our daily lives. So is it that we are putting extraordinary amounts of attention on all manner of things that we wouldn't before and therefore things feel like they have slowed down?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that we're paying attention to things for which we previously were in kind of script mode. We could just operate according to our automatized scripts. But now suddenly a doorknob might have the virus on it, or somebody over there is sneezing. We're attending to things much more so than we normally do. And this seems to expand our days. And yet, we have to make a distinction between time as it is currently experienced and time as it is retrospectively experienced. Those are two different things. So the latter, retrospective attention, is based upon memory. So now when every day seems like a Sunday, when we're kind of almost in a spaceship, looking down at the Earth, that we have no reference point anymore for what day it is. And every day seems to be basically Sunday. And in retrospect, the days seem to merge into a blur.
Okay. Professor Ravelli, let me bring you back in here. As a physicist, how do you think through what Professor Ulrich C. is talking about in terms of retrospective experience of time?
Well, my first reaction is that it's absolutely fascinating what people are saying about how do we experience time. And it seems to me that ultimately it's very similar to what I was saying before. Mm-hmm. He's telling us that for us, time is sort of the counting of the information that we have. If we process more information, time goes a different speed, so to say, that if we process less. And what I was saying before is that there's no real time in itself. It's just the counting of things that happen, like a clock oscillating or something. So there's a time relative to the clock and a different time relative to my brain. And I think that that's ultimately the nature of time. There isn't an objective outside thing, which is time. There are things that happen and different ways of counting that give us different notions of what time is. That's the deep, profound flexibility of the notion of time.
At the quantum level, does time even exist? Is it a factor that is part of your consideration as a theoretical physicist?
Oh, that becomes really, for me, for a physicist, the most fascinating part of the story. Because when you go to the full-blown knowledge of the way the universe works, the physical universe works, namely relativity and general relativity and quantum mechanics, and you try to bring everything together, it's not that we have totally clear ideas, but we have tentative theories. And in these tentative theories, time becomes so complicated that you just prefer to forget about it. You don't talk about time. In fact, in the main equations on which me and many of my colleagues are working in quantum gravity, there's just no time at all. There are clocks, there are neurons, there are things that happen, there change, as you were saying at the beginning, and you can count change, but there are so many possible notions of times, because in a sense, each little thing is dancing by itself, that is easier to just write the equation that describes the relation between these and just forget about any fundamental notion of time. So time does not exist at the fundamental level, which does not mean it is an illusion. Time for us is totally real, very real, of course, and for a clock is very real, but there isn't a preferred time.
Okay. It's making me think I should have stuck with my physics studies because I could have then reached the point where we just abandoned T as a factor in any equation. I love
that. That's correct. The basic equation on which we are working, there is no T.
That's so amazing to me. But Professor Ulrich C., how does that... It almost sounds... Okay, this is a stretch. I will grant both of you in advance that this is a stretch, but it almost sounds as if the two of you are talking about the same things from your respective disciplines, right? The relative nature of time. And so in terms of how it works in the context of our neurobiology, Peter, it seems that we have this ability to slow... maybe unconscious ability to experience a slowing of time. But then there's also the acceleration or even the freezing of time, which I think, you know, it's one of the reasons why people say, there's this thing that happened to me 20 years ago. I literally remembered it as if it were yesterday.
Yeah, so probably the most powerful form of memory that we have is called a flashbulb memory. And this happens when we pay incredible attention, when some very dramatic event happens. So, for example, you know, where were you on 9/11? You can probably say the color of the room, the people you were with, what you were wearing. You know, this is an extreme version of what's called episodic memory. And this also is tied up with attention. So our feeling of the significance of events is very much tied up with what we pay attention to. Now, most of the time, you know, in our pre-COVID lives, a lot of the time, we weren't really paying attention. We were sort of operating on scripts or schemas because we were so familiar with what's going on. And that automatization is beneficial in the sense that we are efficient and we're not spending a lot of attentional resources. But it is also a bit of a danger in that we are not paying attention to what's going on. Now, little kids, when they come to the world, they're full of attention. They're noticing all kinds of little things, you know. So a kid might say, hey, Mom, look, this tree has white bark. And she says, yeah, that's a birch, Jimmy. But Mom, this caterpillar has red eyes. Look at it. Jimmy, can't you see I'm busy? I'm on the cell phone, right? So what does Jimmy learn? He learns to actually become automatized and say, oh, yeah, that's just a caterpillar. Oh, yeah, that's just a birch, instead of paying full attention. Now, a child, though, before automatization and becoming a sort of a categorical being, pays attention and experiences the world very slowly in its extreme detail. Whereas an adult often will have lost that and lives now in this world of schemas rather than things as they actually are.
I mean, we call that childlike wonder, right? And we sometimes lament the loss of it. But now I feel like many millions upon millions of adults are lamenting the loss of the external indicators, right, that we use to measure time, to understand how the world was moving from day to day. I mean, isn't that part of what makes everyone feel so uncomfortable at this moment?
Well, this feeling of discomfort is not necessarily a bad thing, right? Because living in a sort of zombie mode where you are your persona rather than your person, you paid a certain price for that. And maybe there's an ability here now in this very strange situation of lockdown to turn lemons into lemonade, you know, and start paying attention again like a child. You know, instead of just saying, oh, that's an ant crawling across the table, pay attention to that ant. And then you'll notice its extreme particularity.
Well,
and beauty.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, Professor, but we have some voicemails from some listeners who talked about experiencing this moment with their children. Here is Liz from the Hudson Valley in New York. And Liz called us to say that even though she is staying home with her two kids, just like she does during summer vacations, this time period feels different.
Previously, during summer vacations or times when the kids weren't in school, the days felt so long during any breaks that they had from schooling when they were home with me. And now it feels like the day goes much faster for some reason. And other friends of mine who have young kids remarked to me, I can't believe I've been doing this for almost 7 weeks already.
Liz also shared with us ways that her family is coping with the change.
We make sure to celebrate Fridays because after a while, the week can start to feel like one big continuous circle. And so we demarcate the weekends by really enjoying Fridays, maybe ordering a pizza and just celebrating as though it was something different when the weekend comes, even though it's the same as it is during the week.
That's Liz, an On Point listener from New York's Hudson Valley. Professor Ulrich C., you heard Liz basically saying she's instituting or reinstituting some kind of regularity, some kind of schedule. I mean, isn't that a good thing to help us manage this period of warped time?
Yeah, I think she's basically giving her time landmarks, you know. She's defining reference points so that it doesn't all seem to merge into one giant Sunday, which is a good thing, I think. You know, we've all heard the saying, especially from people who have kids, that, you know, the days go by slow, but the years go by fast. And I think, you know, we again, with retrospective time, we hang our sense of duration upon these key events. Now, 9/11 was a huge event, and so that seems to really stand out. But really, you know, in our normal lives, we say, okay, on Monday I have this meeting, on Friday I have that meeting, and we hang our sense of time on those sort of temporal landmarks. And in the absence of those landmarks, it all merges together retrospectively, even though in the moment, it might seem to actually last longer.
Professor Rovelli, I wonder if in the extreme discomfort that many people are feeling by being confused about what day is it and the blurring together of events, days, months, weeks, is there potentially something positive about this that we have an opportunity to reassess even sort of how we measure our own existence? If time itself can be a thing that's so easily changed in our experience of it, maybe we ought to be rethinking, some of the things that we just presume are foundational to our existences.
There's so many levels in which we are temporal beings.
Yeah.
And we have long-term memories about ourselves, of strong moments of the past, but also we have a narrative of our entire life. And I think, if I may, that one of the things is happening in this difficult situation, we hear people dying and counting number of people dying every day with the news. Of course, people die also when there's not a pandemic around, but we don't think about that unless it comes very close, unless it's somebody in our family or friends. And then we think about death. Now we are seeing death much more. So I wonder if this fact isn't sort of bringing closer to our eyes something we know rationally that exists, but we usually prefer not to think about, which is the finiteness of our life. And that changes our sense of time, because the future, we don't live as if we were immortals, right? Mm. And now it's a little bit more difficult than usual to live as if we were immortal. Somehow something which is there is coming in front of our eyes. I don't think this is bad. In fact, I find this is, it makes me more serene, not more worrying. This is our life. It's short, it's beautiful, it's marvelous, and we're all struggling together to allow each one of us to have it a little bit longer. And we're aware of all that. So perhaps there's also collectively a sense of recognizing how precious is our life.
Yeah. Well, we are talking this hour about what the pandemic is doing to our sense of time. And I'm joined today by Carlo Rovelli and Peter Ulrich C. There's so much more to discuss when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about how the COVID pandemic has warped our sense of time. And now in the course of this conversation, I'm even wondering what I mean by we're talking this hour, because what is an hour now? I'm joined today by Carlo Rovelli. He's a theoretical physicist and best-selling author of The Order of Time and Seven Brief Lessons on Physics. He's among the founders of the loop quantum gravity theory. And also with us is Peter Ulrich C. He's a professor of psychological and brain sciences at Dartmouth College and author of The Neural Basis of Free Will. And here's what On Point listener Rama in Gloucester, Massachusetts told us. He says he's feeling time speed up.
Days are flying by, even though I'm not working per se, still getting up early. The days are flying by. It's like, whoa, it's already 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and all these things I still wanted to get done and do. And put in a busy day of doing lots of cool stuff, and the days are flying by. So I think the clock's going even faster.
That's On Point listener Rama in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Professor Rovelli, there is something that you told our producer Anna Bauman in the process of preparing for this hour that I'd love you to share with us. That, you know, you mentioned, you heard Rama talking about the clocks. We just presume that the standard sort of 24-hour clock and the equal sort of slicing of that 24-hour clock across the day is how we have always perceived or even measured terrestrial time, but that's not necessarily true. That, like, in the Middle Ages, did we look at clocks differently? Did we call hours different things?
Yeah. Yeah, in the Middle Ages, hours were more flexible than ours. This is a story. The division of time in days and night, of course, is completely natural, and it's all over the planet.
Right.
The division of day in 24 hours, it's very common in the Mediterranean civilization. It's very ancient. It goes back to Babylonia. But so there are 12 hours in the day, 12 hours in the night. But in the, also the centuries of Middle Ages, 6 o'clock was sunrise. And 6 o'clock in the afternoon was sunset. Now, if you think for a moment, this means that in the summer, of course, in summer, in the Northern Hemisphere, the days is much longer than the night, and in the winter is the opposite. So that means that in the Middle Ages, 1 hour in the summer was much longer in clock time than an hour in the winter. So the notion of hours for a very long time was sort of flexible depending of the season. An hour is longer in summer and shorter in winter. And it's all only when mechanical clocks started to be widespread at the end of the Middle Ages that an hour sort of standardized and became attached to the clock time and not to the separation between sunrise and sunset.
Wait, so this is all just, it's settling on me right now. You're saying that in the Middle Ages, in the winter, when the period of daylight was the shortest, as you said, sunrise and sunset were still pegged to 6 o'clock. So an hour wouldn't be an hour. It would be like 45 minutes.
Shorter.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Okay.
That's okay. And if you read the gospel, in fact, in Matthew, how do you say in English?
Matthew.
It's pretty clear at some point. One of the stories is pretty clear that 6 p.m. is already in Roman times. It's sunset by definition.
I see. So
you're right.
We have had a world in which human beings were perfectly okay with the fluidity of even basic definitions of what time is.
Yes, yes. And of course, another thing that happened much more recently is that until centuries and a little bit more ago, in fact, less than that, every little village was a little bit out of time with respect to the next one because noon was when the sun is just on top of you at the zenith. So, and in fact, that's one of the reasons for which many old churches have a sundial, because you would would regulate the clock of the church on noon. But of course, noon on New York is not the same as noon on Chicago. Mm-hmm. And just move a few miles and it's a little bit different. So if you had a good clock, you had to rearrange every time you do a few kilometers.
Wow. And of course, we've subsequently seen that much of standardization of time has been driven by things like the railroad and stuff.
Happened at the moment of the railroads when we sort of agreed to standardize. And what is remarkable is that when we agreed about that, just in the same years, Einstein realized that an exact synchronization of clocks is impossible. So it's really a compromise, the agreement. We say, well, let's all have the same time. But the physicists tell us it's not really possible, but it doesn't matter because it's too small, the corrections. So time is really a lot of conventions.
I see. Well, Professor Ulrich C., let me turn back to you here, because the history of the change, the way that humanity has changed how it collectively perceives time is absolutely fascinating. I'm wondering what you think the long-term effects of this current disturbance in our perception of time could be for individuals.
Yeah, I think that this could be quite momentous, actually, for our civilization, in the sense that, well, we know that, you know, millions, tens of millions of people are now suffering, and it's really terrible. And yet, you know, pain, whether physical pain or emotional pain, is a signal that we have to change something. You know, if I stick a knife in my thigh, the signal says, you got to get that knife out of your thigh. But now I have this terrible suffering of having, say, lost my job. Well, of course, there's the pain of having lost the job, but there might be, as, you know, Carla mentioned, a more existential form of suffering when we start asking ourselves, you know, who am I? What is real? You know, and I think that Long-term, well, there's a Jewish saying I like. It's that suffering teaches us to want the right things. Now, of course, if you get a brick on your head, that's a kind of suffering that doesn't teach you much. But other forms of suffering can really teach you as a signal, hey, I need to change something. Now, I think we're very different from other animals in that our consciousness is bifurcated. We have one form of consciousness in common with, say, a tiger or a dog, and that we're very perceptual beings with emotions that feel our body in the world. But in addition, human consciousness is bifurcated in the sense that on top of that, we have mental models and narratives about the world. And, you know, science is all about creating such models of the world, which might be right or wrong. But some of these narratives are about ourselves, and some of those might be false. So let's say I'm a businesswoman who just lost her job on Wall Street. So my narrative about myself has gone from I'm a successful businesswoman on Wall Street who went to Princeton, blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly I've lost that story about myself. And that's extremely painful. Maybe I have to replace that narrative with something else. Maybe that narrative is, oh, I'm a loser or something. But there's great hope, I think, in that people can realize, hey, there's all these narratives about myself and about the world. And those might be right or wrong, but really what is really real is my perception of my body in the world with its emotions. And if we attend to that, we can start to see reality maybe in a different way that is free of all those narratives.
So I keep coming back to what you were saying earlier about how so much of this in terms of our perception of time is determined by what we pay attention to and how we pay attention to it. I understand that you have maybe a poem that might capture the opportunity that this warped sense of time is presenting us with.
Yeah, so this is one of my favorite poems. This is by Mary Oliver, one of the great poets of the English language. It's called The Summer Day, and I'll read it, all right? Here it goes. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who's moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who's gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day long. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
That's the Mary Oliver classic poem. Why that one? Why now?
Because by paying attention, we don't focus on our models of the world and, you know, stories about ourselves. We focus on the here and now. And we look at that little caterpillar with red eyes or this grasshopper, and we see the amazingness of reality. You know? So maybe we can turn the lemons of the suffering of our financial crisis and people being fired and dying left and right from this terrible virus into the lemonade of focusing our life again on what is real, what is authentically real for us. You know, it reminds me of a saying, you know, I grew up in Manhattan, and the saying went something like this: why do bankers get paid so much money? The answer was because they're getting paid to live somebody else's life. And I think many of us, you know, might discover, actually, I was living somebody else's life. Maybe I can take this time to reevaluate and focus on what is real for me and who I really am.
Well, Professor Ravelli, we have but a mere minute left in this conversation. It has been absolutely just amazing. What would you suggest that we do with this new knowledge of time and how we perceive it?
I think what Peter has been saying is great. I have a book, the title is Reality is Not What It Seems. I think that this disruption, like all disruptions, might allow us, as he's saying, to sort of step out of our mental habits, and the disruption of time structures in particular, and view things differently, and that may be an opportunity.
An opportunity. Well, Carlo Rovelli is a theoretical physicist and a writer, among the founders of the loop quantum gravity theory and director of the quantum gravity group at the Center for Theoretical Physics at Aix-Marseille University, and author of a number of best-selling books, including The Order of Time and Seven Brief Lessons on Physics. Professor Rovelli, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you very much, Megan.
And Peter Ulrich See, professor of psychological and brain sciences at Dartmouth University and author of The Neural Basis of Free Will. Professor Ulrich See, thank you so much for spending this time with us as well.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Well, folks, I know it is hard to imagine, but one day in the future, this pandemic will be history. It will become part of the shared story of our collective past. So what are today's historians doing to help their future colleagues? Well, the New York Historical Society is temporarily closed to the public right now, but researchers there are actively and safely collecting COVID-19 objects as part of the Society's History Responds Division.
Part of our goal in this collecting initiative is to make people think about what's around them and what's in their life that will resonate with people in the future.
That's Nina Nazionale, the director of library operations and curator of printed collections at the New York Historical Society. The History Responds Division was created almost 20 years ago in the aftermath of 9/11. For this disaster, they're looking to document the heroic efforts of medical personnel, stories of COVID victims, effects on businesses, schools, and cultural groups, and the creativity born of isolation.
The other day, I was taking a morning walk, and signs had been posted on lampposts in the park, but they were clearly children's drawings, as if they were official city signs. Be sure to keep 6 feet. And then another one was, cover your mouth when you cough. You know, it was in crayon, and it was this lovely scrawl of a kid. And so I think as people live their lives and they look around them and they see the drawings in apartment windows that mostly children have done of rainbows, and to realize that we would like a sample of those drawings so that it can be part of the permanent record of these weeks and months of the crisis that we're living through. A woman who gave birth in a Manhattan hospital a few weeks ago has promised to donate to us the hospital bracelet. Here she is admitted to a hospital to give birth during a pandemic, but somehow had the thought to contact us and say, I am considering donating the bracelet I was wearing. And of course, the hospital bracelet will have the date on it. All these things to keep in mind as potentially something that future generations will want to know about. I tell you, it's time sensitive, both in terms of getting the word out to people that we're collecting around event, but also in the sense that certain things might disappear. Likewise, somebody in their apartment self-isolating might not think that maybe they've marked a pair of household gloves with the word bleach because they want to keep it separate, you know, from the ones they use to do their dishes. But they may not realize that those gloves, in the context of the pandemic we're now experiencing, are a part of history. History's happening all around us. It's happening right now, and we're part of that history. All of us are part of that history. So we want to document the way people live their lives day in and day out. An individual object or a series of objects tell you about the lives of people, the details, the textures of daily life. And the COVID-19 pandemic is characterized by changing plans and approaches. Nothing is routine. So it's so about the story unfolding, and it's the series that really tells the story.
Nina Nazionali is Director of Library Operations and Curator of Printed Collections at the New York Historical Society. She was talking about their History Responds Division and the efforts underway to collect right now documentation around our shared experience of COVID-19. Now, if you're in New York or in the surrounding area and you have materials you'd like to donate, go to our website, onpointradio.org, for more information on how to do exactly that. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.